Welcome to RTB Live Extra, a new podcast brought to you by Reasons to Believe. This week, we'll answer science faith questions we didn't get to during this week's RTB Live broadcast. If you want to catch the show live, tune in on Thursdays at 1 p.m. Pacific on the Reasons to Believe YouTube channel.
So Rebecca Ruffin says, realistically, how soon could we have a vaccine for COVID? And Robert McKenzie asks, any thoughts regarding the vaccine possibilities? And so, yes, great questions about the vaccines. I will tell you the last number I heard that there are over 50 different vaccine candidates worldwide that are in development and approaching at least preclinical, if not phase one clinical trials. And so what you may want to do is you may want to go out to my blog site at reasons.org and look for Theorems and Theology. That's the name of my blog. And look for the ones on vaccine safety, because there I actually outline what the different phases are in order for the FDA to license a vaccine. Now, those phases are specific for U.S. manufactured licensed vaccines. Europe has another set of similar phase definitions for licensing in Europe. And so different countries have different licensing prerequisites. But there is a vaccine at Oxford that is being developed from Oxford researchers in, obviously, in the UK in conjunction with AstraZeneca. And that's the one that's furthest along. They're now starting phase two, three combined clinical trials. And so you have to go all the way through phase three clinical trials before you can be licensed. And that's true if it's in Europe or in the US. And so it's the furthest along. Moderna is another biopharmaceutical company that is in phase one clinical trials. And they are approaching the end of phase one. And I think they're going to phase two as early as September. There's another, Johnson & Johnson is also developing a vaccine. And they're currently in preclinical trials, which means they're still in the laboratory. They're testing and evaluating in animal models. And they will be going to phase one clinical trials by the end of this year if things go well. And so those are the three that I am aware of their specific phase in the clinical trial sequence. There are, as I said, over 50 being developed. Some of them are RNA platform vaccines. That's the Moderna one. Some are protein-based vaccines. That will be the Sanofi GlaxoSmithKline vaccine, which is also just now in preclinical. There are Johnson & Johnson and the Oxford vaccines are both adenovirus vectored vaccines. And so each one of those different formats, RNA platform, protein, adenovirus vectors, each one of those will have certain challenges. And the phase one, two, three clinical trials will help pick apart which ones of those are going to be the safest, which ones will be the easiest to dose. And what we want is we want sort of a moderate dose with a single vaccination. We don't want to have to do multiple vaccinations. We want something that will be stable for storage and shipment because we want it to be available globally. And we want something to be efficacious. So it needs to elicit an immune response, a proper immune response, and one that's durable. And so answering all of those questions is what takes time to get a vaccine that we even think is going to be a very strong, good candidate all the way through the trials it needs to go through before we can start to manufacture it and market it after it's received licensing, either from the FDA or the EU or whatever the licensing agency is. So how soon do I think there will be one? I think if we have one by next summer, which will be a year and a half into the pandemic, which is what the earliest estimations were for, 18 months, I think we'll be doing fantastic. The question is, will we have more than one? And more than one is probably a good thing because you're going to have limitations on how much we can manufacture. You have an entire global population other than those that are going to be anti-vaccine, whether it's because of Gates conspiracies or just anti-vaxxers in general. But most of the global population will want immunity, and this will be the fastest way to herd immunity. So I'd say maybe we can expect something available to us in the U.S., maybe if things go well by next summer. So we've still got another year to go. Okay, the next series of questions are from John Pinto, and he's asking about the physiology of the disease. He asks, isn't the problem with COVID more that the immune system is overreacting rather than it is compromised? And he refers to something called the cytokine storm. And this is true for SARS and for MERS and for SARS-2. Whatever the viruses are doing in the human body, they have pretty wide distribution to different types of tissues. And the immune response that is taking place is what's called the cytokine storm. And it's because different types of immune cells are being recruited to the site of infection. And the way that the immune cells communicate with each other is to release chemical compounds called cytokines. And because you have a variety of immune cells responding in a variety of tissues, releasing a variety of cytokines, you get this storm-like effect where the immune system does seem to be sort of overreacting. And so we don't have a great handle on how to control that, but some of the early data suggests in some of the drug analyses that if you can inhibit elements of the inflammatory cytokine response, that you may be able to lessen the severity of the disease. And so those are questions that scientists are very interested in addressing, asking and answering, collecting that data systematically, and then making informed decisions based on those specific studies. That's one of the reasons why we're having a hard time sort of ascertaining whether or not we should be using hydroxychloroquine, which is a question that Timothy Boyle asks. And it's because there's anecdotal evidence that in some patients, it seems like hydroxychloroquine was working. And yet, it's not tested in its ability to actually treat the specific virus with that cytokine storm going on in many scenarios, right? And so you have to do case-controlled studies where you're administering the hydroxychloroquine at a particular time, at a particular dose, or a particular number of doses. You need to know when to start it. You need to know how often to dose it. And you need to know if there are underlying conditions that are counterindicative. And then you need to know if it's efficacious in those dosing systems that you're trying to adopt. And the only way you can do that is through systematic study. So what hydroxychloroquine has been in systematic studies by the NIH for the last 4 or 5 weeks, I think. And just yesterday or the day before, I saw that the WHO was discontinuing one hydroxychloroquine study because of basically a lack of supportive evidence that it was accomplishing what they wanted. But that's only one of many studies that are out there trying to ascertain whether or not this is going to be something that's available, safe and efficacious. If so, administered when, how often, at what dose. There are other studies that have definitively shown that hydroxychloroquine is not the drug that you want to use if you have rheumatoid arthritis or lupus. It actually creates severe side effects and can lead to fatalities related to heart dysfunction if used in those patients. So there's mixed information, there's a lack of information, and there are ongoing studies, and that's how we're going to pick apart the question about hydroxychloroquine. You just have to be patient for some of these answers. Nina wants to know about if we're having, she keeps hearing that we're having a bad flu season, and how can that be true if social distancing, sheltering in place, staying at home, and masks, and et cetera, are working to help contain COVID? Well, the hard push for social distancing back in late February or early February was so that we could slow the rate of infection of COVID being passed from human to human in the population, because in February, we were still very much in not the peak, but just off the peak of flu season. And so what we don't want, and we didn't want to happen, and what we don't want to happen in the fall is for COVID infections to be taking place on top of influenza infections. And so influenza season typically ends the middle of April. It can go as late as the end of April. It can go into the first week of May. But the good news is that the vast majority of the US, except for New York City, was well out of flu season by the time our COVID numbers started to climb. And that's true because we were pushing for social distancing and staying at home in those urban areas early while we were still in flu season. I thank God almost every day that the governor of the state of California was the first one to say stay at home, because we have, for the most part, dodged the bullet in the sense of we did not have overwhelmed healthcare systems because we got out of flu season before our COVID numbers climbed. And so that's the difference. Flu season typically peaks, Nina, at the last couple of weeks of January and the first couple of weeks of February. And so that's typically when the flu season is peaking. And the flu season is very seasonal. Flu is much less hardy than SARS is. And actually, I'm going to jump ahead and answer a question that Derry asked about whether or not there's going to be some sensitivity to SARS in the warmer months. And it's a really complex question to answer because Brazil is sort of subtropical, and Brazil isn't yet in their winter, and they're already having phenomenal rates of daily new cases. Brazil's growing faster in its COVID situation than any place else in the globe right now. And so with all respiratory pathogens, we see some dip in the summer months, regardless of when your summer is, right? Or whenever your summer is, we see some dip. Some are very seasonal, like influenza, but there's strong evidence that SARS-2 won't be very seasonal. The question is, how much of a dip will we see in the summer? We're bound to see a little, but how significant it'll be, we don't know. At this point, I'm gonna let Mark answer some questions.
Sure, thank you, AJ. I wanted to add to your comment, we talked about it before, to Nina's question. I remember telling my wife early in this when the lockdown started, you know, all the stay at home, the mask, everything. I said, you know, the only problem with this, if it's successful, people are gonna call into question why we needed it, because COVID cases didn't overrun hospitals and all that. And I told her that very early on, and you saw me in front of her telling and reminding or letting her know that this was not, I didn't make it up. I was concerned because it's kind of like deterrence theory. So long as it works, you can't prove that it worked for that reason.
Right.
I was worried early on. So I just
wanted to. It's terribly frustrating, isn't it? If we're successful, no one's going to believe it was true.
Right. Yeah. So that's how successful it is. So Dylan Carr asked three separate but sort of, I think, related questions that I kind of want to address in one piece, and I think you'd like to jump in on it too. So he asked this question: how would you recommend Christians engage in the world right now and keep from being too cavalier on the one side or too fearful on the other? That's a brilliant question.
Yeah.
He also asked, how can we love our neighbors while taking the virus seriously, reopening businesses? And then finally, Christians who are distrustful of CDC and fear a one world agenda as a result of promoting ideas similar to the pandemic or plandemic video, how would you lovingly engage these brothers and sisters? I think the first thing I would start with, something what I said in the beginning or during the regular broadcast, I look to Daniel as my model of how to live during really tumultuous times. You know, it's read Psalm 23 in a group setting and ask the question and do a Lectio Divina on it. Do you really trust in God's sovereign purposes? Daniel did. He took his cues, I think, from Isaiah 49:6. He lived a light he became a light to the Gentiles, despite being stripped from his homeland, despite all that, and probably being castrated and being forced to serve in a pagan court. He kept his faithfulness to God. So I think, but the other thing that we see with Daniel, and he reminds me of how we are to live, you know, if our agenda is Matthew 28:19, to bring about, get disciples made from every nation, tribe, and tongue, we do it by means of 1 Peter 3:15. Always be prepared to have a defense for the hope that's in you, yet with gentleness, respect, and a clear conscience. And that's the part that is, I think, missing in a lot of people who engage in conspiracy theories, sometimes even the YouTube channel's chat room. Psychologists will point out that up to 90 some odd percent of the meaning of our communication, especially when it's emotional, comes in the form of nonverbal communication.
Isn't that interesting?
Isn't that fascinating? So it's me looking at you, it's smiling, it's my body posture, it's how I say things. And if we're not gentle and respectful of people who disagree with us, lovingly encouraging them to look at these things, we can be brilliant in our answers, but absolutely turning people off to the gospel or to gentle correction. And so I think it's important to keep in mind. To me, this is Hugh Ross probably convinced me more of his approach to creation by the manner in which he approached the subject than the actual substance when I first met him and encountered him. And it's that gentleness, or that respectfulness. And yet, he's faithful to the gospel. He's faithful to his mission. And I think that's something that we have to do as well. And so I think probably the most important thing we can do is behave in a way that shows respect and gentleness towards those who disagree, but be firm. You know, Daniel was firm in his conditions. He didn't let, you know, the ministers conspire. He let the ministers conspire against him, but he let them do that so that God would get the glory under King Darius in Daniel chapter 6. So we can do that too, even if people disagree with us. That's fine.
Yeah.
If you want to add anything there, I'm going to go. If not, I'll go to Daniel's question.
Yeah, I'm going to jump in on Dylan's last question, at least the one that we have here last. It says, how would you recommend Christians engage in the world right now and keep from being too cavalier on one side and too fearful on the other side?
Yeah.
I think that, you know, we really can serve wisely in this, right? So that's my third bullet point. Think clearly, love boldly, serve wisely, pray always. And by serving wisely, I mean, you know, wear your mask when you're out in public. Stay socially distanced from those around you. And even if you aren't fearful for your own health, those measures primarily aren't to protect you. They're to protect others from being infected by you if you happen to be asymptomatic. And so, and I think that if you're practicing your own hand hygiene, where you're washing your hands with warm water for 30 seconds with soap to a lather, you're doing a lot to get rid of the virus. If you're limiting the amount of touching of your face, if you're wearing a mask, if you're saying socially distance does actually help protect you, because somebody else's respiratory droplets are dropping off before they get to you if you're keeping your distance. If you're doing all of those things, you're not being cavalier. And if you're doing all of those things and still engaging in public activities and in public dialogue along the lines that Mark just shared about the dialogue, then you're also not being fearful or spreading fear, right? And so I think that's what new normal looks like until we have a vaccine.
You know, AJ, I love that, because you have once said early in this, you said, you know, loving your neighbor during this time means wearing a mask and being respectful. I love that. That's absolutely critical, I thought. So Daniel asks, what do you think day to day will be like once the country opens up again, like average things, going out to eat, movie theaters, et cetera? Well, Daniel, that's a great question. I'm not sure we know. My suspicion, and then AJ, I'm going to hand it to you, because my suspicion is we have a new normal, and it's going to be that way because we talked about in the live stream, we talked about this chart that a biologist shared with me, that the second wave and the third wave, but really the second wave, was far more destructive than the 1918 influenza. And so if we're still in the first phase and we have a second wave coming, potentially coming, we may need to change what we do permanently, at least for a period of years, not and until we get herd immunity, if God wills that people can find one soon enough. So, and that really dovetails with, Richard Piercy asked the question, many churches in California may be opening in the next few weeks. What do you think of the newly released health guidelines? Are they appropriate and scientifically based? And that kind of doves with Jen from Ohio, who talks about states are reopening and what's the best strategy to go by. I think it's going to take wisdom for all of us. I know I see it with certain businesses. I've seen it with different places of business that I go to get water because we like purified water. Our water here for a period of time is not great, so we have to get purified water. And they have, you know, wear a mask when you go in. You limit it to one or two people at a time. Same thing in our favorite bread place, one person at a time. The guidelines that I've read, and we're still going to hash them out because we have to meet as a board tomorrow, so it'll be the day before you listen to this. We're happy to figure it out in our church. Our building capacity is 377, and our church is significantly less than that. But you can't socially distance with that, you know, 25% of that. It's not possible. Yeah. So I think we're going to have to be very careful. We're going to have you know, hand sanitizer stations. The challenging question will be, if someone comes in and doesn't want to wear a mask, do we kick them out? I mean, I don't know the answer to that, you know? Those are tough questions.
I think that you as a board have to have those conversations. And I think that's really, you know, unless there are state guidances or county or local city guidances about what they're allowing organizations to do when they come back to meeting, then I think that it needs to be discussed and it needs to be thought through carefully at the church level. And so, you know, for whatever reason, I've got a voice in my church denomination here in the Los Angeles area at this point, and we haven't yet opened up, and we were the first to shut down, and it was basically because of information I had passed on to people making the decisions, which was not the outcome I was looking for. I was just wanting them to put all these precautions in place, but they read the risks, and they said, we're not taking those risks. So so yeah, the masks again, you know, certainly at my church, I would advocate strongly for, if you're not willing to wear a mask, this is a highly vulnerable population, and you're not welcome to attend live. You're welcome to live stream from home, but if you don't have a mask on, for the sake of community and Christian union and loving the more vulnerable in our congregation, you can't come. So, otherwise, you know, I went to a friend's church, which had service by appointment only on Sunday. And they're doing services all week long. The two clergy people are passing off the service, and they do two or three a day. And each one is by appointment only. And you can have up to 10 people at a service. And everybody comes in with a mask on, and they sit in different pews. And you know, when it comes time for communion, everybody gets up and they take their mask off, but they walk forward and they're handed elements by the priest or the pastor who has a mask on, and who has just used hand sanitizer before handing you your elements, and you consume them and put your mask back on, and then you go sit back down. And so that's what social distancing looks like, at least in one environment that I saw. But those types of things need to be thought through, you know. So at my church, it's like, when we reopen, will we have people sitting in every pew? No, we'll probably have people sitting in every third pew, right? And people will wear masks, and there will be hand sanitizers, and people will come forward in a single direction and leave in a single direction that allows social distancing the whole time, and you'll stop briefly to receive the communion elements from the priest or the pastor. And so, so you have to think through these things. And, and, you know, honestly, there have been so many outbreaks in churches that to not think on the side of caution in this area, I think, is irresponsible.
And I would agree, because, you know, if you look, we tend to be older and grayer in our church populations, and they are the more vulnerable.
And people with comorbidities, and you don't always know who the comorbidities are.
That is the key. And then there's also the fact that, you know, choirs, there's been evidence that choirs can produce a lot of
that's aerosol. Because when you sing, you project, and it's no longer 6 feet.
You do, right? Yeah. And so there's going to be changes to how that's done and how far people stay away. Because what was the choir? There was a choir that like 16 of the 19 people got COVID because they were in practicing together. So,
right. So choirs probably need to wear masks, you know, seriously, I'm serious.
There are new guidelines. We've seen the legal ones that have come out for us in our area in Upland. The problem I have is San Bernardino County is actually increasing the cases daily. And I'm tracking it. It's going from tens of new cases to in the hundreds to now over 200.
Oh, that's interesting, because just last, like 4 or 5 days ago, there were only 5 or 6 counties in California that hadn't met the requirements to reopen, and San Bernardino wasn't on that list of
six. They're reopening, and yet I see that the number of cases is still going up. So I'm wondering what's going on. I don't know. We have to hash it out. So it's going to take a lot of wisdom and time, and hopefully trial, but not error. You know, that's the problem.
So we have a couple more questions. We have one from John Pinto, and then I think we have a couple more at the end here. So John Pinto asks, do we have a good handle on just how prevalent SARS-2 is in our population here in the U.S. and has implications for understanding serology antibody test results? Oh, and does this have implications? Oh, this has implications for understanding serology antibody test results. Yeah, so John, it's disparate information depending upon where you live. So New York City, the last I heard, they had a pretty good handle on the population in New York City was about 24% had tested, were seroconverted, had basically recovered from the virus. So in other areas, I don't think that the public health system has that far on top of things. There's a little bit of confounding data. Most of the antibody serology tests are good. The FDA has 12 that are in emergency use approval. They also had about 20, I think 15 or 20 that were basically dropped from like, don't use these. The rate of false positives is too high. And so you just, if you want to get a handle on this, I think the closest you're going to be able to getting an answer to the questions you're asking specifically is to check with local public health departments. And so for instance, Los Angeles County Health Department will have some fairly good statistics, but it won't indicate what percent of the population has been antibody tested. And so it's still incomplete information. Another site you could look for links or information is the one that I referenced in the live stream, the Hopkins Center for Health Security. They actually have an interactive page there where you can see how many new cases in the US, and then the deaths are broken down into states and or localities, but they don't have data for all the states such as Massachusetts for like cases recovered. And so you still don't know exact numbers, but you can start to get at answers for specific areas if you go to individual public health departments. So Keith asks, what's the expected or predicted future of the virus's ability to infect? we cannot prognosticate about the future. we see through a glass dimly at this point, but what we can talk about is what is it seem like the replication factor is, or the R-naught value, or that value of like how many people does one infected person on average pass the virus on to how many other people. And the last I saw an R-naught value was somewhere between 2.5 and 3.5 people. But we know that there are super spreaders. Mark just mentioned one, you know, where a choir, probably one person ended up infecting more than a dozen other people. And I, in my first live stream, I talked about other super spreader events for SARS-2. And so, you know, we don't know when the virus will accrue a biological mutation that might affect rate of transmission. We don't know if there are mutations out there already in the global population that would suggest that there is a more transmissible form or a less transmissible form. Right now, all the data I've seen suggests there's one, only a single strain. There's something, if you go to Trevor Bedford's Twitter site, which I mentioned in the live stream, there's something called a D strain and a G strain, and that's referring to an amino acid at a particular site in the virus protein. I think it's the spike protein. And they're speculating that the D amino acid instead of the G amino acid is a more highly transmissible form. And yet Trevor has done some epidemiological number crunching and presentation out there that suggests that's not true. It's not necessarily true that it's untrue. It's just that the data we have right now doesn't support that conclusion yet. And so people are keeping an eye on that. But not a direct answer to your question, but information that bears on why I can't give you a more direct answer, Keith. So I think that's it. I don't know that we've missed any. Have we, Mark?
Nope, but I wanted to add something to it because sure. I think to tie it together, and it's similar to what you just said, you know, one of the problems with intelligence is anticipating the future, right? And yeah. Sue Gordon, she's a now retired deputy director of national intelligence, put it this way, and I love this. How many of you like to play with jigsaw puzzles? and she'll get an audience to raise their hands. How many of you like to play with a jigsaw puzzle without seeing the overall picture?
Yeah.
Yes, a third question. How many of you like to see, to play jigsaw, to do a jigsaw puzzle without the cover and only have one quarter of the pieces? How many of you like to do a jigsaw puzzle without the overall and with only 25% of the pieces and then give a high level of confidence in your answer, what's going on?
I love that.
And it's true with this stuff too, right?
Yeah.
Especially when you're looking in the future. We have a lot of uncertainties and a lot of only a few pieces of the information. So I think, you know.
That's brilliant. I love that, Mark. Well, okay. That's great. You know, I want to come back to the highly vulnerable population in my church and a comment that you made as well, you know, or that we exchanged, where it's like, you can't always tell who the high vulnerability population is if you're talking about underlying comorbidities. You can if you're talking about age. I mean, obviously you can say, oh, this person's old or older. But it's kind of like, you know, would you invite a strange population of teenage kids to a summer camp and only serve them peanut butter without knowing who has peanut allergies, right?
Good picture.
So you can't tell by looking at somebody whether or not they have peanut allergies. And that's the problem with COVID-19 is you can't tell by looking at somebody if they have some of these underlying comorbidities.
Yeah.
So I think that's it. I don't really have anything else to say. Mark, I'm very happy to give you the last word.
No, AJ, I absolutely love this, doing this with you. It's a joy. You remind me of how much more I have to learn and study and grow. You're brilliant. It's fun to engage with you, and it's a lot fun to cooperate with you. I think the last thing I would say, though, is remember 1 Peter 3:15. As you go out, as you engage other people, let's do it with gentleness and respect and a clear conscience. Let's be light to the world, because this world really needs it, especially in this day and age.
Thank you for listening. Your prayers and financial support are reaching people with reasons for faith in Jesus Christ, our Creator and Savior. To allow Reasons to Believe programs like this to continue, make your gift today at reasons.org.